For Politico, I'm Ryan Heath, and this is Global Insider.
This week, we're trying something different. We're bringing some new voices and a new type of discussion, courtesy of the wonderful Ivo Dalder, president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, who served in a past life as America's ambassador to NATO. Hi, Ivo.
Hey, Ryan, how are you?
Very good, very good. Now, you convene some really smart global conversations up in the Windy City and online. And I thought to myself, why not share one of them with all of our audience? So buckle up. We're in for a roving conversation on Russia's war, Germany's deep dependence on Moscow, and NATO's northern expansion. Are you ready, Ivo?
I'm ready. Let's just dive right in.
Okay, let's roll.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ivo Dalder, president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Phase three of the Ukraine war seems to be starting any day now. Germany and Europe are looking at how they can stop funding the war on the Russian side by cutting energy exports and also reducing industrial cooperation with the Russians. And Finland and Sweden have decided, or are very close to deciding, that when Russia threatens them, perhaps the best thing is to join NATO. To talk about all of this week, we have an expert panel, starting with Carla Robbins, who is an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and formerly with the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. Carla, great to see you.
Hey, Ivo.
Also with us is Elise Labatt, founder of Zivi Media and contributor to Politico Magazine. Elise, wonderful to have you.
To be with you.
And Ryan Heath, who is the editor of Global Insider newsletter and podcast at Politico. Ryan, great to have you here as well.
Hey, Ivo.
Carla, let's start with you. We're on the verge of a new phase of the war, which seems to be concentrating in the east of Ukraine after the Ukrainians successfully beat back Russian advance on Kyiv and other major cities in the north. A lot is happening. Weapons are flowing. Forces are repositioning. Cruisers are sinking. Bring us up to date about where we are in the war and what we can expect in the next few weeks with regard to the fighting.
So, you know, a few weeks ago, I was just thinking about this, and Elise and I were on together, and we were talking about a potential diplomatic off-ramp. But now it looks like Moscow is determined to fight to the finish, whatever that finish is. You know, Russian troops may be on the verge of taking Mariupol, or what is left of it, part of Russia's drive to build a land bridge to occupied Crimea. And the Pentagon says that Moscow is moving attack helicopters to the border and bringing in additional soldiers and artillery, and it's preparing for what looks like a major battle for the control of southeastern Ukraine. That said, 7 weeks in for what Putin thought was going to be a two-day war, and Ryan was very right to note that this is invasion began 8 years ago, and the Russians continue to prove themselves to be both horrifically brutal and remarkably inept on the battlefield. You know, and the Ukrainians have proved to be far tougher and more competent, as we've been talking about for weeks, than anyone, including us, ever expected. So on Thursday, as you said, Ivo, you know, the Russians lost their command ship. It's not just any ship, it's their command ship in the Black Sea, the Moskva, which was either hit by Ukrainian anti-ship missile or because what the Russians claimed was a fire on board. Either way, it's incredible incompetence. And which raising the question of why Putin thinks that he wants to keep pushing this forward. The Ukrainians are getting a lot more equipment from the U.S. Previously, stuff the Pentagon kept saying, they can't handle it. It's escalatory. We're not going to give it to them. But they're giving it to them now. The Slovaks are delivering what an S-300 air defense system. The U.S. announced this week that they're sending additional, what's $800 million worth of security aid, including 11 Mi-17 helicopters, 18 155 millimeter howitzer cannons. And that's because the battle is moving from the cities and forests to the plains. And the stuff that the Ukrainians could do with shoulder-launched weapons that they could do with guerrilla tactics, they're not going to be able to do in the open field. Is this going to be enough to hold off the Russians long enough for sanctions to work? You know, none of us has a clue. The Russians are inept. The Ukrainians are tough as hell. They have surprised everyone at every turn. But this is really going to be a grinding, awful battle to come, Ivo.
Yeah, it looks like it really a very different new phase of warfare. At least I opened up my newspaper this morning and saw that Bill Burns, the CIA director, had warned about the possibility that if Putin still feels as cornered as he is, we need to take seriously the threat of possibly nuclear escalation, tactical nuclear weapons or a low nuclear weapon. He said yesterday publicly in a speech in Georgia. how worried should we be about the escalation scenarios beyond the immediate battlefield, or even on the immediate battlefield in the East, if in fact the kind of situation we've seen in the last 7 weeks, which is the Ukrainians being tenacious and able to hold off the Russians, continues?
I think we should be very concerned, and we have to just be very clear. We're not talking about a full-on kind of nuclear strike. However, people think that a tactical nuclear weapon is like a little mini nuke. That was the size of a nuclear weapon that was used in Hiroshima. And so clearly there's a lot of damage that could be done. But the whole idea is that this is in the use of nuclear weapons is in Russia's kind of strategic defense policy about if it feels threatened to a certain extent where its safety is at stake, whether its interests are at stake, then, you know, the use of nuclear weapons is justified. And so the more that they're losing, you can see Putin justifying the use of not just nuclear weapons, but chemical weapons. We heard one of the separatist leaders in the Donbass calling for the use of chemical weapons as they move to the southeast in this new phase that Carla was talking about. So clearly the U.S. is very scared about this scorched earth policy, which we saw in Syria, which we saw in Chechnya. And that clearly, as Putin feels that he can't win, you know, as he expected, you know, just kind of going in and sweeping through the country, he's going to turn to more draconian measures. And that's why it's going to be incumbent on the U.S. and its NATO allies. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Ivo, about arming them more and look, giving those really sophisticated offensive weapons and defensive weapon systems that they're looking for. You know, I was listening to one of the Ukrainian members of parliament today, and she was saying that the Ukrainians have proven that we are, you know, a robust army and can take on the Russians. Mm-hmm. And the Ukrainians really feel that they could win this if armed properly. But there seems to be still that lack of confidence by the U.S. and others that maybe Ukraine can't stave off the Russians, but they can't really defeat them. And so maybe that's, you know, in addition to not wanting to poke Russia for this kind of larger world war, which I feel we're moving towards anyway, that's the reason for the reluctance to really go full in, ride or die, as they say, with the Ukrainians. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think you're right that it feels like there is an ever-increasing urge to get closer to the line of thinking about how can you help the Ukrainians win without escalating to World War III, and how do you draw that line? And Ryan, at least I'm not going to duck it. I'll come back later on what I think, Ryan, but I want to hear from you, because it seems to me that the rhetoric from the president in particular, I mean, he called what is happening genocide, which is a remarkably strong statement. He said, I don't know whether that's legally right or not, and that's for reasons, because it triggers all kinds of needed responses on the part of the United States if it is declared a formal genocide. But there is this question of the moral clarity on the one hand that the president is putting forward, and the means by which we are helping the victim of what the president calls genocide. How do you see that playing out just generally, both in Europe and in the United States, but also what pressure does that put on the U.S. in particular to start thinking about what more weapons, and frankly, is there anything the U.S. needs to do directly itself?
All the lines are starting to get blurred now. What started as very clear lines about what the U.S. and allies would and wouldn't do, it's all starting to shift with these unilateral declarations of genocide. You know, we're now supplying helicopters to Ukraine after this whole drama about not being able to supply the Polish planes and then replace the Polish planes that would have gone to Ukraine. It's all starting to shift. And under the old, very clear lines, I can't see how Russia wouldn't walk away with some of the territory or all of the territory they now hold. But as you start to shift the lines, maybe it's possible to think of a Ukraine victory. But what's not happening, as far as I can see, is any holistic looking at what does Ukraine really need in the next 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, if it were to push Russia out, if it were to win this war. Instead, we have what is still a dribbling out of resources. Like, I'm not saying that 800 million isn't worth it or isn't sort of significant, but it's not based on what does Ukraine really need. It's based on this sort of political triangulation of what is possible now, or let's look ahead to the next couple of weeks. And you see the same approach with the sanctions. It's just endless rounds of bits of sanctions. And as far as I can see, you really need a conference of allies to nut out what's the overall ask here and work back from there, see how much of the solution you can deliver instead of constantly just sort of tactically inching forward.
I think you guys are all right on this, but the thing that has changed, and certainly the Pentagon stopped talking about what the Ukrainians can and can't do, what their competence level is. They're much more willing now to talk about what can we train them fast to do, which is a really different thing. And the lines, as Ryan said, are blurred and almost disappearing because save two things. One is given the MiGs, things that could get flown directly over the border really quickly, and we'll see whether or not that line holds too. And the other thing is obviously putting boots on the ground. But, you know, and this is the other thing we're going to talk about. A few weeks ago, you know, would we have been cheering on the notion of NATO expansion, further expansion? I mean, all of these lines are blurring very quickly. And the self-deterrence we were talking about a few weeks ago, we're not talking about anymore.
But super quickly, and I think, Eva, we're going to tee it up for you now. And I think we really want to, you know, as former ambassador to NATO, I think it's incumbent on you to let us know how you feel. But still that message about the whole kind of psychological idea that we can take it up to the line so that we can't provoke Russia, I feel still is holding back that what the Ukrainians are saying is, we're defending you. We're making it easy for you to defend your borders by taking incoming from Russia.
I mean, if NATO wants to defend Ukraine, it can just do so. And all it takes is a political decision, and in fact, a national decision in case of Poland or the United States or someone else. But the real line, so I do think the lines are shifting. I think Ryan is exactly right. There's one that hasn't blurred, and that is the line of a direct US/NATO military involvement in shooting at and shooting Russian military forces. So the direct military confrontation, which we spent the entire Cold War trying to avoid for fear that that would lead to escalation. Jake Sullivan on Sunday said that our goal in the end is for a free and independent Ukraine, a weakened and isolated Russia, and a strong and united West. So that's one goal. And the second goal is to avoid World War III, to not get into a situation where you no longer can control what is happening and the escalation that comes with it. The problem is that this is a two-part game. Whether we get to a direct confrontation isn't just a decision of the United States. It's also the decision of Russia. And there's two pieces that I worry about. One that we talked about, a nuclear, chemical, or some other threat, which really does change the calculation of risk, it seems to me, on the part of the United States and its allies. And the other one is the Russians are now starting to threaten really going after the supplies of weapons, which they haven't done. In part because they didn't think it was very important. Now they know it's important, although the Neptune missile system that supposedly sunk this cruiser is a Ukrainian-produced weapon. It's not given by any NATO country. That's, I think, where the challenge lies for the alliance, which may be shifting over to the other side. So one is on the military side. How do you help Ukraine beat Russia? But the other one, Ryan, is on sort of how do you weaken Russia? How do you weaken and isolate Russia? And the Europeans seem to be in a pickle here because they are so dependent on the Russian market and in particularly on Russian imports of commodities, not least gas and oil, that there is this, you know, as Olaf Scholz keeps on saying, the German chancellor, we want to make sure that the Russians get hurt, not us. There's a real tension here and a real problem.
And there's no escaping the numbers. I think we have to ground it not in sort of rhetoric and fear, but look at some of the cold, hard numbers. And the amount of money that Europe spends on Russian oil and gas each day is approximately how much they've given to Ukraine over the past 8 weeks. Not all of that goes to the Russian state or can buy Russian weapons, but, you know, around about 40% of it can go into that lane. So in any given week, essentially, European countries are giving more to Russia than to Ukraine, which is not the way you help Ukraine win the war, and it's not the way you end dependence on Russia. And to break that down or to hone in on the main culprit, the anchor of that problem is Germany. And Germany has had some very good reasons not to slam the door on Russia. And I'm speaking in the broadest historical sense here. Nazi Germany was responsible for 25 million Soviet citizens dying during World War II. That's a lot for any country to bear on its conscience and to factor into its policy planning. But that doesn't really explain why Germany hasn't changed its calculus since 2014. Obviously, because there have been a broader set of sanctions around Russia's Crimea invasion. We also saw the atrocities in Syria. You know, the Kremlin guns down its domestic political opponents. There's been any number of moral reasons for Germany to think about its longer-term calculus. And it really wasn't doing that. It fought long and hard within the EU to push forward with the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. There's a range of political figures that have been at the top of that. Not all social democrats, but Gerhard Schröder, the former chancellor, is the biggest name there. It's why Frank-Walter Steinmeier was told he wasn't welcome in Kyiv this week, because he's a proxy for Schröder in these discussions. Merkel, who we all love to love, definitely played a hand in all of this as well. And what we were really looking at this week was corporate Germany and how it continued to self-deal and the nature of the deep ties that German corporations have had with Moscow and who enables that and what are the platforms that enable it. And two things that anyone listening should know about are something called the East Committee, which goes back decades and that was designed to foster links with the Soviet bloc amongst big German conglomerates, and Munich Security Conference. And I don't put myself forward as an expert on the conference, so anyone who's been more involved than me, feel free to talk about that. But obviously, that's also been a platform for knitting together some of these ties between the Russian state and big German companies. And we're talking about the biggest companies, the Siemens, the BASF, Allianz, Deutsche Bank. And then to finish on another number point, Germany's still doing $60 billion a year of trade with Russia, down from a peak of about $100 billion a year in 2012. So the sanctions had to have some effect. But this is why you see Europe still divided. Until Germany really gets on board with an energy embargo, it allows those people more favorable to Moscow, the Hungaries and so on, to keep Europe divided. And not a lot's going to change until Europe unites on this.
It's an important picture. And Ryan, I really appreciate putting both the history and the current situation in there. And Elise, I think as Ryan said, lots of us have looked at Angela Merkel as really a historic figure, particularly when she opened up the borders in 2015 to a million refugees and a leader in so many ways. But there's sort of a number of places where it seems she's fallen down. One, of course, on the continuing business interaction. Second, the decision to shut down the nuclear power plants, which really are hurting right now because it means that we have coal and gas as the only ways to have electricity. And the question is, to what extent do you think, looking at what's happening in Germany, that there's a real urge to change? How confident should we be that the initial decisions that the Germans made in the immediate aftermath of the invasion are going to stick?
I think there's still a real ambivalence there. And I mean, when you go back to Angela Merkel, it's the fact that she was kind of, I don't want to say the buffer, but she was really that mediator between the Europeans and the US and Russia, because she had one of the closest relationships with Putin. And don't forget, this is a woman who grew up in East Berlin, in East Germany, speaks about that time very eloquently, but is still kind of shaped by that. And so she always kind of, as you know, Ryan was going into the history, she always tried to kind of lean into that history in terms of maintaining that relationship. And if you remember during Syria and during 2014, she was very reluctant to really impose those hard sanctions. And Germany was often the standout. I think there's still an ambivalence of the current chancellor, and certainly on the part of industry. I mean, only days, you know, after Crimea in 2004, you had the CEO of Siemens traveling to Moscow to meet with Putin, and you still kind of see those connections. So I think it's going to be more of a political decision. I think it's going to be once the United States says to the Germans, you can do business with Russia or you can do business with us, and you have to make a choice. And then the choice is going to be much more obvious. I think they're going to be kicking and screaming all the way. But the more, I think it's going to be incumbent really upon the US to impose that kind of moral choice. But also, I think you need to also give the Germans an alternative. And you see, it's not just an issue of energy. It's an issue of supply chain, of what's going on, right? You know, we see, you know, global supply chain problems, but I think whether it's here in Russia or you've seen with the kind of Belt and Road Initiative in China, that the US is very good at asking for that moral choice, but not really presenting alternatives. And so I really think it's going to be incumbent upon the US to offer those energy alternatives, economic alternatives, supply chain alternatives, so that the choice is easy. And so they're not kind of cutting off their arm.
Yeah, it reminds me of a slightly different story at the Munich Security Conference. Ryan, a few years ago, a U.S. senator stood up and railed against, wasn't a German, in this case, was an East European president, about their fact that they were relying on a Huawei for 5G. And they turned around and said, well, that's fine. What can we buy from you that is the alternative? And the answer, of course, was there none. And so, Carla, just reflecting on Elise's point, you know, the U.S. has been very careful, the Biden administration has been very careful not to make this a fight with allies, but to maintain unity and to try to help them reach the right kind of decisions. But, you know, there's a limit to how much you can do that if the wrong decisions keep on being made. And particularly with gas, that seems to be the case. We're helping to find alternatives to gas, including shipping more LNG, liquefied natural gas, to Germans and others. But how much power does the United States have?
These countries are, certainly France is becoming as polarized as we're becoming, and they're looking at an election in which there's a very, you know, God, Le Pen is, you know, doing real well in the head-to-head polls right now. And one of the reasons why they're holding off on this proposal, even bringing it up about taking the next phase step on, you know, cutting off oil and gas purchases, which would be incredibly, as Ryan said, incredibly important to do to bring pressure on Russia, is because they don't want to play into, you know, the Le Pen voter thing. And that's not surprising, because look at how the, you know, gas prices are playing politically in the United States. I mean, Biden was out there this week pushing EPA to agree to sell ethanol during the summer, which is going to raise smog levels. Biden, Mr. Green, is doing this. He's so worried about the polarizing political effects inside the United States for something like that. So, yes, we should be saying you're with us or against us to the Europeans. But if you do that and you get a Le Pen win in France, what does that do to NATO? You know, these are really hard things to manage. And it's not just, you know, Scholz came up with this, everybody applauded him, but he still hasn't delivered that military package. He's been dragging his feet and he's under a lot of pressure. I know what I want to do. I want them to cut off the purchases. I want them to deliver that equipment. And I don't want these societies to vote Le Pen in. Those are hard things to do.
Brian, one last word to you before we jump over to the next topic. There is internal, some ways, public opinion in Germany is kind of ahead of where the elite is. They do think it is important to take a moral stance. It's quite remarkable how public opinion as a whole has shifted. And the toughest line are by the Greens, who now favor nuclear power again as part of a transition. Does that give you confidence that, you know, while this debate plays out, we're only 8 weeks in, that's not a lot, that in the end we will move in the direction that Germany will lead into the direction that we all think, including many leaders in Germany, think we should?
The leaders of the three relevant committees in the Bundestag all support the oil embargo as well. It's all shifting in the right direction. It's just a question of how long it takes to shift. And then there is one other factor, and it gets to that point of being in the business of hurting Russia rather than democracies hurting themselves. Okay, great. We turn off the oil and gas tomorrow. Let's imagine that. Well, what we'll end up doing, because the nuclear isn't on and the renewables haven't come on soon enough, is it will simply be bought from Middle East sources to a large extent. And Russia will end up selling to Asian countries who aren't involved in the Western sanctions instead of those Asian countries buying from Middle East sources. That isn't cutting off Russian money either. So there are many layers to the onion that have to be considered. And even though it would make us feel more comfortable to just get rid of that dependence in Europe, doesn't mean the money is going to be cut off from Moscow.
Yeah, I think that's true, Ryan, with one exception, that whatever flows through a pipeline can't be diverted, particularly gas. It's less on oil, which is why both the dependence on gas is greater, because you can't easily find gas somewhere else, but it's also Russia's dependence on the European market for gas is greater.
Can I make just one other really fast point, which is while the money may be flowing into Russia, there are things that are flowing out of Russia. They're having a huge brain drain, and they're going to have increasing supply chain problems in coming weeks. You know, there are things, their factories, such as they are going to grind to a halt, and that's going to have domestic pressure.
And the last issue for us to look at is this really remarkable change in public opinion in Finland and in Sweden, even more in Finland, where Alex Stubb, foreign minister and prime minister, tweeted just earlier this week, he said he thought that 80% of the Finns now soon would support Finland a country in which neutrality is, I think, written on the forehead, would join NATO. Tell us a little bit about what is happening in these countries and how quickly this seems to have changed the politics in both countries and in NATO.
That's right. I mean, look, the invasion has led to this kind of head spinning about face in public opinion in both countries. And both prime ministers now at a joint press conference, we were just saying women, I might add, of Finland and Sweden are saying that their countries are both considering joining NATO and are actively kind of debating it, introducing. Finland just introduced an assessment about the pros and cons of joining it. And that's going to be an active debate and decisions could be made sometime near the summer. Both countries have been notoriously neutral. They're both members of the EU, but not members of NATO. But now 50% of people are in favor of joining NATO originally before the invasion. Now it's 62% if Finland joins. And in Finland, it was 68%. And now it's 77%. So you see that rising. And Vladimir Putin had made these threats against both countries, particularly Finland, because it shares a border with Russia, to say that that would, he threatened serious political and military consequences. Now, if they joined, now they're actively considering joining. And NATO is really, you know, again, we're going to throw back to you, Ivo, to talk about how quickly this can all be done. But seriously, you know, debating applications for membership and are widely expected to join. And now the alliance is actively debating what happens in this in-between period while their membership is considered to make sure that Russia doesn't take advantage of this period before the two countries were official. But I also think they were famously survived the Cold War as independent and unoccupied democracies being neutral, but still have moved towards the West. And so, you know, they've been able to kind of straddle this neutrality while still being towards the West. I think they pretty much made their choice. And it's not to be neutral in this brutal aggression against Ukraine, in the threats that they face. And I think what we're going to see is if both countries join NATO, I'll be interested to see what comes out of Ukraine in the sense that there is this open door for membership, but it doesn't seem to be open for Ukraine. And so while I think it's definitely the right choice for Finland and Sweden, there's going to probably be a lot of hard feelings on the Ukrainian side, even the considering when you look at how the Ukrainians are fighting the Russians, they would certainly be an active and valuable member to the alliance.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. And I think that debate is not over by any means on what Ukraine status is going to be down the road. It's just hard to do it in the middle of a war. But,
right.
But Carla, I think one of the issues that Elise pointed to is this transition period. There's the reality that, for one, actually, you can't apply for membership. You need to ask to be invited. So there needs to be a NATO decision to invite them. And then if everybody says that's okay, you need to ratify a change in the treaty. And we know how notoriously difficult it is to ratify changes in treaties, particularly in the U.S. Senate. I don't know what the last time is, but that we actually ratified a treaty. I'd have to look, probably when Montenegro became a member of NATO back in 2017. And there's this issue of how do you, you know, you're saying one day you have an Article 5 guarantee, but until there's a ratification, what happens then? There's a big debate going on in the United States on this internally. And I don't know if your sources that you've been talking to have told you anything about how, what are we going to do in this transition period?
From what I'm hearing and reading is that there's been discussions with the Brits and with the Finns and as well as with the Swedes on the notion of some sort of bridging security guarantee. And as you were saying earlier, Ivo, we can negotiate anything we want. It doesn't have to be an Article 5 guarantee. It can be a bilateral or trilateral guarantee. And the Brits seem quite eager to do this. So I'm sure that that will be the bridging guarantee. And I'm sure the Russians will have a lot of chest pounding. I mean, Medvedev already this week said, we're going to put nukes in Kaliningrad. So there's going to be a lot of escalatory threats along the way here. But if they, the Russians, think that this is going to make the Swedes and the Finns less likely to join, that ain't going to happen. That's another one of these things that they really didn't
Boomerang.
Calculate. I don't know. I'm not hearing that there is that much pushback inside the military establishment in Washington. Are you hearing that there's a great deal of pushback about this, Ivo?
No, but there's a theology that is happening, which is that, you know, you, and particularly since the theology is the one that is at the core of how we're going to respond to the current crisis. We're making this argument that we will defend NATO territory by every inch. But if you're not a NATO member, then apparently we don't defend you because that's what the Ukrainians are finding. And so how do you deal with that problem at a political level? My view is, it's very simple, which is that if you're going to say, well, we want to give an Article 5 guarantee in 5 months from now, then I'm happy to do the same thing between now and then. I don't see the reason why you wouldn't in terms of the commitment to defend the country that would be triggered once they are members of NATO. Once you've decided to bring them in, why not do it as a unilateral one? That's one. And of course, they are EU members, and the EU has a collective defense provision.
So there's the transitive property of the EU-NATO relationship. And let's face it, in the end of the day, why was Ukraine not invited to join? And why would these countries be invited to join? There is a certain who gets invited to join the sorority and who doesn't, you know, who's ready and who's not ready. These people are ready for the security guarantee. That was, you know, that's the implicit guarantee here. So, I mean, I just don't see, I understand the theology, but the fact that they're EU members, to me, I think resolves it really quickly.
I hope that's the case. Ryan, what are you hearing on this issue, both on the transition and the argument is, of course, you invite members only if they contribute to the security of the North Atlantic, North American area. And one way you're creating a new commitment to defend a country with an 800-mile border. But another way, you're bringing in, you know, not Montenegro or North Macedonia, you're bringing in Sweden and Finland, pretty big military powers. How should we calculate that in, as part of the decision-making process?
They're ready to be useful from day one, but it would probably go some way to making those bridging systems come into effect as quick as possible if they would allow NATO forces onto their territory during peacetime. Norway doesn't do that. They only allow it during designated exercises.
With NATO.
Yeah.
Well, no. Norway is a NATO member, of course. But Norway has this restriction that you can't have a permanent basis of NATO forces. Yeah. Except for you as Marines, they're there for a very long time.
So I think it would be smart if Finland didn't take the Norwegian approach there. But that's a very important question in and of itself, where we're doubling the border of NATO with Russia if Finland is invited in, none of which is an argument against it, but it is a very practical consideration. And on that point of Russia threatening to bring the nukes into Kaliningrad, well, they're already there. So I think it's a pretty ridiculous threat.
You know, just to close out this discussion, it does, as I think Elise said, boomerang, it really, a conflict that ostensibly started because NATO was coming too close to Russia's border, it will end in the end with NATO extraordinarily close to Russia's border. One, as Ryan rightly said, more than doubling, I think, the border area between NATO and Russia, given Finland's long border. But also, you know, whatever the nature of the relationship is with Ukraine and NATO, bring Ukraine and NATO far closer together.
I think, look, you're talking to someone who thought he would never go all the way this in, and I'm fully admitting I thought he was going to just take another chunk of the Donbass and call it a day. So I think perhaps he might still be, you know, it looks that's where he's kind of positioning himself. To be honest, before the invasion of Ukraine, no one was really asking for the Crimea back. This latest invasion, no one was asking for the Crimea back. That might be all he ends up with. And there's some kind of face-saving way to, you know, have a little bit more. I mean, Zelensky has said, I'm not going to give up an inch of our territory. But at the same time, I know these things will be discussed. So I think that there is some probably face-saving way to allow him to climb down if he's willing to take it. And I think there's needs to be a lot more thought to what his, you know, we've talked about this a lot, that a caged animal is less rational than a free-range animal. And so I think there needs to be a lot more thought to finding a way for him to climb down from this before he really does launch a tactical nuclear weapon. He does not care about the international consequences. What he cares about, he does not care about sanctions. He does not care about death and destruction. There are two things that are going to make him, only really one thing, and there are various ways you can look at that, is his own political survival at this point. And if he feels his political survival is a little bit more guaranteed by escalating the nuclear threat, he'll do that. If the army comes, not necessarily the army, but maybe the special services come to him and say, you know, you need to climb down from this, he may do it that way. But it is all going to depend on what he thinks his political survival is. And you can say what you want about what a brutal leader he is, what a maniac he is. He's the one that is in the driver's seat in Russia right now.
We'll be watching closely what the pressure is on a caged animal, as well as what would happen if you let the caged animal out of the cage. One of the reasons to put him in a cage is to make sure that they don't roam around. And this is the dilemma, I think, that we're all facing here. But I want to thank for this week, really brilliant discussion, Carla Robbins, Ryan Heath, and Elise Labatt. Thanks so much.
Wei Dong Lin produces this show. Our executive producer of audio is Jenny Arment. I'm Ryan Heath. Subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Global Insider.